Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Robin and Jeremy have the day off. President Obama marked Memorial Day today by laying a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington National Cemetery. Earlier in the day, he hosted a breakfast for the families of men and women who died in service to the country. While today is a day to honor the war dead, we begin with a look at the latest challenges for the Department of Veterans Affairs. Over the past 5 years, the department has declared more than 4,000 living veterans to be deceased and canceled their benefits. This is the latest in a number of problems at the VA, including long wait times, bad record keeping, and failure to discipline employees. Ben Kessling, staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal, joins us with more. Ben, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thanks.
So first of all, can you just tell us, how did this mistake happen? How do living veterans get declared dead?
Well, the VA doesn't keep any records on what the causes are, what the sort of administrative screw-ups are that lead to this. There could be human error. There could be some problem with matching in computers. But nevertheless, about 4,000 people over the past 5 years have been declared dead and then subsequently had to have their benefits reinstated.
Hmm. And so, I mean, I take your point that they don't necessarily know exactly how it happened, but the scale of it, I think, is what's astonishing. Several thousand people. Was it caused in part by the fact that the VA has been trying to solve other problems as well?
I don't think it's necessarily been caused because of that, but it is indicative of the vast array of problems that an organization like the VA faces. I mean, this is one of the largest organizations in the federal government, and there's just a number of issues that pop up with whenever you have a bureaucracy this large. And we've seen that over the past few years, stretching back to when Secretary Shinseki was in charge, and the wait time scandals that caused his eventual resignation.
Well, so let's take a look at exactly what has happened to at least one veteran that you spoke with. You talked with Michael Ricker, a veteran. And first of all, how did he know or realize that the VA had, for some reason, thought he had passed away? Did his benefit checks just suddenly stop?
The benefit checks were cut off, and he got a letter in the mail saying, to the estate of. And people all often get these letters in the mail that say, dear so-and-so, we're sorry that your husband or your wife has passed away. And the husband or the wife is the one who opens the letter. For Mr. Ricker, the problem for him was it seems that it was human error, that someone who was entering in information into the system wrote him down as a gentleman with a different middle initial. And the fellow with the other middle initial had indeed died. Things were cross-checked and did not catch that error. And Mr. Ricker's benefits were subsequently cut off.
Was it easy for him to then get the error corrected?
Well, the thing with Mr. Ricker was he corrected the error, and then pretty soon after that, the benefits were cut again, because by the time he corrected everything, something somewhere in the system had noted him as dead, and it wasn't corrected immediately. So his benefits were again cut. So this happened twice to him and had to be rectified.
Wow. So I understand that he had to eventually get the help of his congressman to prove that he wasn't dead.
Well, when these sorts of problems pop up for veterans, and if any veterans are listening out there who are having any kind of issues that they can't seem to get resolved, it really is beneficial to go directly to the VA to talk to whomever you can, or to enlist the help of representative in the U.S. government. So congressmen and senators can really do a lot to get the ball rolling to fix some of these issues. But yes, he did go to his congressman, and that was part of the reason that he was able to get this error corrected, and also part of the reason why we're able to get some of these numbers that came out. The congressman dug into the issue and got these numbers released.
Hmm. Now, what has the VA told you about efforts it's making, if any, to fix this problem of accidentally declaring veterans deceased when they are not?
So what the VA does now is it has this thing called a death match, which it takes any time they think someone has passed, they match it against the Social Security Administration's records. And the Social Security Administration, even though they're not a true clearinghouse for when people pass away, they have a pretty comprehensive database. But there are still errors that happen. The VA also has instituted a new program where rather than just cutting off benefits, they will send you a letter saying, it seems to us that you are deceased, and if they don't get a response within so many days, then the benefits get cut. So they've put in a couple safeguards, but we don't really know yet the results of all those safeguards at this point.
Mm. You know, Ben, a little while ago you talked about how this is sort of the latest in a long line of problems that have been plaguing the VA for years now. I mean, what does it tell us about the Veterans Administration's progress in repairing sort of the fundamental issues that it's facing? I mean, it seems as if perhaps it hasn't made that much progress.
So when I talk to the VA about the problems with cutting off benefits for people who are presumed to be deceased, it happens, I mean, less than 1% of the time, which doesn't seem like it's a huge error. But as one reader wrote me after the story came out in the paper, a reader wrote me and said, the VA says this only happens 1% of the time, but when it happens to someone, it's 99% devastating.
Right.
That's one of the issues that the VA faces, is that every time that there's an error, whether it's wait times that cause people to wait so long that it exacerbates their medical condition, if benefits checks get cut, it's a major, major problem for that individual person. Part of the thing that the VA faces when it's making these changes is there's a lot of things that the VA can't just do. Secretary Bob McDonnell can't just snap his fingers and make stuff happen. He can make a lot of changes. He can institute quality control practices. He can do things. But at the same time, there's a lot of stuff that's in U.S. code that has to be changed by lawmakers. And that, as anybody who's following the way that Congress is working these days, sometimes can be an uphill push to get things through.
Well, Ben Kessling is a staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Ben, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
10,000 baby boomers turn 65 every day, according to the Pew Research Center. And the National Council on Aging finds that almost all of them have at least one chronic health condition, meaning it's likely someone will eventually have to take care of them. Family caregivers face multiple stresses that can affect their own health. And today we visit one facility in Savannah, Georgia, which is helping provide care for the caregivers. Gabrielle Ware from Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting reports.
Lenny Doe sports a Yankees hat and jersey with a thick New York accent to match. He self-describes as a people person, but right now his face is somber. He's trying to get his 78-year-old mother with Alzheimer's to use the restroom. It isn't easy.
You got to go to the bathroom. The bathroom is right there, Mom. I didn't say about the chair. You said you got to go to the bathroom. Come on.
Caring for his mother is not Doe's only struggle. In 1999, he was shot in the head 4 times. No one expected him to survive.
This is the bathroom, huh?
But he did. His mother nursed him back to health, so 4 years ago, when he found out she had Alzheimer's, he wanted to care for her. Later health complications resulted in his regular use of a wheelchair. Doctors think stress from caregiving contributed to his decline in health. Doe isn't sure, but says it doesn't matter.
You can't never repay your parents for nothing, for all that they do for their kids anyway. I just wanted to show them my appreciation.
It's very common for caregivers to neglect their own health. The National Center of Caregiving says the results can be increased levels of stress, depression, and even premature death. Most people will take on caregiving duties at some point in their life, according to a report released by the AARP, but many have little to no training.
It's not like we say, as we're going to college, oh yes, and probably another responsibility that I'll have in the future will be caregiving.
That's Paula Hudson. She's the manager of the Adele Caregiver Institute in Savannah. According to officials at its partner, the Rosalind Carter Institute for Caregiving, Adele may be the only institute in Georgia that provides direct hands-on training for caregivers.
We recognize that, you know, there was definitely a void in the community with regards to helping caregivers.
Especially when it comes to paying for services.
In-home care is very expensive.
And many don't want to put their loved ones in a facility, according to Deborah Haggerty. She's the assistant nursing professor at Armstrong State University in Savannah and former caregiver to her mom.
I was paying $18 an hour for 24-hour care.
That's over $3,000 a week. She didn't qualify for Medicaid, so the costs were split between Haggerty and her mom.
You know,
Caregiver Lenny Doe is watching his mother's brain deteriorate before his eyes. She's cradling a teddy bear she believes is her child.
And my baby, cutest little thing I ever was.
He says he's stressed every day, but he won't give up.
I'm not a quitter. I don't let nothing stop me or slow me down from doing what I need to do.
Despite his determination, Doe says he still has moments of doubt. The Adel Institute hopes to give caregivers like Doe the tools, training, and support they need to keep caring for their loved ones. And Congress may chip in, too. A bill before the U.S. Senate would allow caregivers to apply for up to $3,000 in tax credits a year. For Here and Now, I'm Gabrielle Ware in Savannah.
In this election season and in the age of wall-to-wall political commentary, there's a lot of talk about disaffected voters. We've all seen the news reports about underemployment and unemployment, dreary scenes of shuttered factories and crumbling railroads. But even then, it's all too easy to gloss over the actual lives of the people living in struggling towns. Now, few have written about the frustrations of working-class America as compassionately and with as much humor as Richard Russo. He won a Pulitzer Prize for fiction in 2002 for his novel Empire Falls, a portrait of a fading New England mill town. Russo's latest novel is Everybody's Fool. It's the sequel to his best-selling 1993 novel Nobody's Fool, and it takes us back to the town of North Bath, New York, a fictional town that's somewhere on the spectrum between struggling and cursed. I spoke with him recently about the new book. Richard, let me ask you, I know so many of your fans are so happy and excited to go back to North Bath in Everybody's Fool. What made you think it was time to revisit?
It's all Howard Frank Mosier's fault. He's one of my writing buddies. And since that novel came out, he's been fixated on Rub, Sully's sidekick. Yeah. And he loves Rub. And every time I see Howard, he says, what's going on with Rub these days? Sully and Rub, what's going on? As if these were people were really alive and I would know.
A lot of people felt like you brought them to life so well.
Well, and that's the ultimate compliment. Yeah. And I always felt that way. But unfortunately, I never had anything to report to Howard until, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. I heard this wonderful story about a man who climbed up into a tree with a chainsaw. And sat on a limb and actually sawed off the limb that he was sitting on.
Oh, my.
So that it fell to the ground. I mean, he was sitting on what was left of the limb with his back against the trunk of the tree. Yeah. But nevertheless, when the limb fell down he lowered the chainsaw down, he realized, of course, that there was nothing to grab onto and no way to swing down into the ground. And he had to wait for hours until his wife came home and found him there. And I thought when I heard that story, I thought, well, Rub Squeers would do this. Mm-hmm. And the next time I saw Howard, he asked, what's up with Rub? And I told him that story. And in the telling of the story, as if it had actually happened to my fictional character, it kind of dawned on me that I was having an awfully good time.
Yeah.
and immediately saw a way to bring Sully into the scene. So that was, as I said, that's Howard's fault. And here we are, you know, 500 pages later.
Well, thank goodness for him. Then.
Yeah.
You keep saying it's his fault, but we should all thank him.
Well, the book is dedicated to him. That was my thank you, Tom.
Yeah. Well, so I'm curious, though, because in Everybody's Fool, Sully is back with us, but he's not really the center of the action here. And why is that? I mean, because he's one of those legendary characters in American fiction that, as we talked about, people did fall in love with.
Yeah. He was based at least in part on my father, and even my mother loved him. but when it came, his story was basically, I don't want to say his story was over in Nobody's Fool, but his conflict had been resolved. Mm-hmm. And I heard another story. I'd heard a couple of interesting stories about local cops. And one of them was just so ridiculous, and it put me in mind of then-Officer Raymer. And I thought, I wonder what his life would be like 10 years after. Has he been drummed out of the Corps? Would he still be a cop? And I thought, no, that wouldn't happen at all. He would now be the chief of police 10 years later.
Uh-huh.
and on a quest. And I like novels that do that. Larry McMurtry has a series of books in which Dwayne from The Last Picture Show is involved. Sometimes he's the main character. Sometimes he's a lesser character. And I really like it when a writer takes a kind of functionary and you discover that here's somebody with a real life. Yeah. You know, it's just before you used him only as a plot device, but now you get to look deep into his heart and soul, and you discover he's just as interesting as the people he was in service of the first time
right.
around.
So tell us a little bit more about Raymer the Raymer that we rediscover in Everybody's Fool. Like, how has he grown? How has he changed in the 10 years since Nobody's Fool?
Well, the most significant event that sets this book in motion is that since we met Officer Raymer, he has married to a woman with whom he was deeply in love, but she has died a tragic death, and it's tragic for Raymer twice because not only does he lose his wife, but he discovers at the time of her accident, she falls down the stairs, slipping on a rug that he has promised to fix, and dies in the fall. But she's on the way out the door. She has her suitcases packed, and he discovers that she was about to run away with somebody, but he doesn't know who. And almost a year afterwards, he discovers in her car a garage door remote that does not open their garage.
Oh boy!
And he realizes that, and he does what I would do, and possibly Magna, what you would do as well. You go around neighborhood to neighborhood, don't you? With that with that garage door opener, and you see if you can find out whose garage that remote would open.
I would probably contemplate it, but I'm not sure.
All right, that's your story. You should stick to it.
Well, I would love to give folks a taste of how you write Officer Raymer in Everybody's Fool, the new book. And we've got just a little passage here. Could you read it to us?
Sure. Police work, perhaps more than any other profession, attracted people for the wrong reasons. In Raymer's case, the desire to be useful. You'd be given orders, and you would execute these to the best of your ability. It never occurred to him that part of the job was figuring out, without being told, exactly what the job was. Right from the start, Ollie had encouraged him to act on his own initiative, to analyze the scene and figure out what needed to be done. Sure, there was plenty of mind-numbing repetition, but most days, especially in the beginning, you'd encounter something new, and there wasn't always time for instructions. In their absence, though, young Officer Raymer had found himself assailed not just by the usual raft of self-doubts, but also by an old, ambient feeling of futility that had been his more or less constant companion since he was a boy in a disorderly house that he had wanted to put right, without having a clue where to begin.
Hmm. That's Richard Russo reading an excerpt from his new book, Everybody's Fool. It's the sequel to the beloved novel Nobody's Fool. Richard, can I ask you, you very deliberately set Everybody's Fool in 1999.
Yeah.
And I noticed that sort of cell phones are sort of there.
Yeah.
Around the edges, but they're not, they haven't quite permeated life in North Bath. And I'm wondering if that, I mean, of course it was a deliberate choice.
Yes.
But how important was it for you to have North Bath still be this place that was unto itself and that wasn't quite as connected to the rest of the world as most places are now?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lovely question. And I did want it to be 1999 because my upstate New York mill towns, one of the things that I've enjoyed writing about them is they do have always existed, as they do in real life, kind of out of time.
Mm-hmm.
And the local restaurant is likely to be privately owned. It's probably not going to be a chain. The donut shop will be privately owned. And that's what I loved about those places, and that's what I loved about North Bath. But in this book, we're beginning to see the encroachment of the rest of America onto one of the few places that is genuinely itself still. But out by the freeway now, there's a TGI Fridays. There are other things out there. There's a reference to a Lowe's that's being built out there. And cell phones, ubiquitous everywhere else, are beginning to intrude on this town that kind of had an identity of its own. So this is in a way, it's a historical novel. It's a snapshot. It's not a contemporary story at all. And that was very useful to me. Upstate New York has changed a lot now in the 2000s.
Well, I hinted in the beginning when I introduced you that there's even though this is fiction, you've long had this authenticity of voice for the people in these small, struggling towns. And I'm just wondering, you know, if Sully were real today, who would he vote for?
Sully. I'm not sure about Sully. Many of the, especially the males in this town, are very blue collar. They have worked the kind of jobs all of their life that have, over the last couple of decades, been outsourced.
Yeah.
And they've missed not only those jobs, but their identities as a result and their sense of themselves in America and America's future. Many of them, I fear, would be voting for Mr. Trump. Miss Burrell, however, would not be fooled.
Well, Richard Russo, he's the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist. His new novel is Everybody's Fool. It is the fantastic sequel to Nobody's Fool. Absolute delight to speak with you, Richard. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for your interest in the work.
This year, the National Park Service marks its 100th anniversary. Today, we're going to check in on the country's oldest urban national park, Rock Creek Park, in the nation's capital. Anthony Linforth is a park ranger at Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C. He joins us via Skype. Anthony, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me today.
Well, first of all, I was wondering, for listeners who haven't been to Rock Creek Park, I wonder if you could just describe what it's like.
Well, Rock Creek Park is nestled in the center of Washington, D.C., and we have a little bit of everything that the National Park Service offers. We have historic buildings. There was a battle that took place on the grounds of part of Rock Creek Park. We have over 2,000 acres of land that we care for, lots of wildlife. This is a great time for migrating birds. And we also have the only planetarium in the National Park Service.
Hmm. And Ranger Linforth, I understand that Rock Creek Park was founded in 1890, but it actually has a history that dates back even further to the Civil War.
Well, there was a battle fought here during the Civil War in 1864, the Battle of Fort Stevens. In fact, it's the only battle in which an American president was shot at. Abraham Lincoln was at Fort Stevens, and Confederate sharpshooters are said to have taken shots at him. It was a battle where General Early of the Confederates had swept up the Shenandoah Valley and was threatening Washington, D.C. from the north, and Union forces here were able to keep them at bay. Mm-hmm.
One of the many distinctions that Rock Creek Park has is that it's an urban park. It's not hard to get to. But I'm wondering, what are the particular challenges that come along with having a national park in such an urban location?
Well, one of the challenges is certainly for some of the plant species that we have here. We have a lot of people that have landscape around their homes, and some of those plants don't mix well with our native plants. And so they're is a constant battle to try and make sure that invasive species don't come into Rock Creek Park. We also are accessible for most people, but there are still certain people who aren't able to get to Rock Creek Park. There's buses that bring people through the park, but there's not a lot of places for people to get off a bus and go for a hike. We're trying to develop some hiking suggestions that allow people to come from the community and utilize the park.
On the other hand, the fact that it is an urban park makes it more accessible than some of the vast national parks that may be better known in places such as in the western United States. And I'm wondering if you think that America's urban parks don't actually get enough attention, given that so many people could go to them, but perhaps don't.
Well, we get quite a few people that come here. And I am truly amazed, though, that every day walking through our doors, we have somebody that says, oh, my gosh, you know, I've lived here all my life, and this is the first time I've come to the Nature Center. We also get a lot of people that come in and say, you know, the last time I was here was 30 years ago on a school trip. Now I'm bringing my kids here. And we're hopeful that they will continue to come and enjoy Rock Creek Park.
Well, Anthony Linforth is a park ranger at Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C. Ranger Linforth, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Just about 34 million people are on the roads this Memorial Day weekend, the most since 2005 and the second highest total on record. According to AAA, gas prices are the cheapest they've been in 11 years, helping to boost auto travel. The cost of fuel is on average 45 cents a gallon lower than it was a year ago. Well, in the not-too-distant future, we may all be making that trip to the beach or that family picnic in our cars, but we won't be driving them. Most major automakers and a lot of other smaller players are developing driverless vehicles, and the members of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers estimate that up to 75% of all vehicles will be autonomous by 2040. Sound unrealistic? Bruce Gellerman from Here and Now contributor WBUR reports that part of that future is on the road right now.
I got the Tesla for environmental reasons primarily, but it's also the safest car on the road.
Jeff Manning owns a Tesla Model S. The electric car already incorporates many of the advanced technologies futurists say will help untangle traffic and perhaps even eliminate road fatalities. Nearly 90% are driver-related. This model is expensive, but government incentives help Manning afford his Tesla, and solar panels on the roof of his home in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, supply free energy. He even makes money selling excess electricity back to the grid.
It's a stylish car. It can fit my family and a great deal of luggage.
It can fit you.
It can fit me. I'm 6'7", and I can't fit in a Volt. I can't fit in the Leaf. I can't fit in the Toyota Prius, and that's why one of the reasons I got this car.
The luxury sedan has a longer range than other electric vehicles, and it does what few other cars today can do. It's a semi-autonomous vehicle. When the autopilot software is switched on, computers and sensors take over. The car drives itself. You said it, but don't forget it.
The driver doesn't need to be laser-focused on the road. They can be focused on the road, but not laser-focused. You're not steering using the brake only if it's a red light.
Take him for a spin?
Absolutely.
As Manning reaches for the door, sensors anticipate his approach. The handle pops out to meet his hand. And like magic, the rearview mirrors unfold. Automotive history fades into the distance. The future is automated.
Let me buckle in. Okay, let's...
All right, let's do it. Now, the car is on. You can't hear anything, but the car is on right now.
The car is on.
The car is on right now. So I'm going to push the brake so we can get in gear.
0 to 60 in under 4 seconds. Heading east on a busy highway, the car's radar and laser system sense the surrounding vehicles. Jeff Manning sets the speed and distance he wants to be from the car in front and flicks on the autopilot software. Sensors lock onto the painted lines on the roadway, keeping the car in the middle of its lane. Manning puts his hands on his knees, turns to me, and smiles.
Your hands are off the
wheel. My hands are off the wheel. I'm not pressing the brake. I'm not pressing the accelerator. The cars in front of us are slowing down. We're slowing down.
Traffic speeds up. We speed up. Manning signals. When the car senses it's safe, it switches lanes all by itself, merging with traffic seamlessly. Every once in a while, autopilot reminds Manning to touch the steering wheel. The car is checking to make sure he's still attentive and ready, just in case.
I think the steering wheel at some point will go away, and you will type on a screen or say out loud, take me to so-and-so, and it will take you there.
Mounted inside Manning's car are 6 small sensors and cameras that are not standard equipment. They're supplied by an MIT research lab. Manning is participating in an experiment to measure not the vehicle's behavior, but his.
So it takes a video of my eyes and to see where I'm looking. And I'll take a video of my hands and the speedometer It'll take a video of where we're going. So it has all this information that I can extrapolate however they want to use it.
What does this change? It changes everything.
Brian Reamer is Associate Director of the New England Transportation Center. It's based at MIT, where he's a research scientist studying human behavior in autonomous vehicles.
It changes how we move. It changes how packages move. It changes how we behave. It changes the future of old age. It changes everything. But there are going to be some difficult growing pains along the way. They're policy. They're societal.
It was Reamer's lab that installed sensors and cameras inside Jeff Manning's Tesla. Data showing how the driver was interacting with the semi-autonomous auto. Developing the hardware is a lot easier than programming the software to make ethical decisions that could be a matter of life and death.
We look at distraction today. It's a problem on the road. What does automation do? It allows us to do more, most of the time safely. However, when the automation determines that it's reached a situation outside the programmer's view of the world, the automation will make very different decisions than we do. Are the robots making good decisions?
If a kid suddenly jumped into the middle of a road, would an autonomous vehicle sacrifice the child to save its passengers? Brian Reamer is also concerned with the economic consequences of driverless cars. No drivers, no fees from driver's licenses. And since autos will be programmed to obey traffic laws, there would be no speeding tickets. State revenues will take a hit. And do we even need police to monitor traffic?
There's a big question. Will traffic congestion decrease or increase as we automate more? So let's fast forward to some point in the distance where I'm no longer responsible for driving. I have a fully autonomous vehicle that shuttles me to work, that instead of sitting in the parking lot waiting for me, goes and picks my wife up at home and takes her to work. The model of that is an increased traffic flow.
More traffic, but less roadway congestion. It's one vision of a transportation future rapidly coming down the pike, as clean energy autonomous vehicles replace our current fleet of not-so-smart gas guzzlers. Every major auto company is getting into the act, but upstarts like Tesla, Apple, and Google are paving the way. And digital technology is driving the change to new business models as automakers become mobility enablers.
Now, the real core question becomes, do we move and continue down a society built upon vehicle ownership, or do we move to one that is based upon ride sharing? They probably more tilt to the ride sharing now, but that's against the basic culture that has existed in this country for decades.
I think self-driving is just taking all the fun out of driving cars.
Barry Steinberg owns Direct Tire, a chain of Eastern Massachusetts auto repair stores.
You know, how can you have fun by just sitting there not doing anything? It's the engagement in the automobile. You're not going to have that anymore?
Well, you'd be able to read your paper, listen to your music, go to sleep.
I'd rather do that in a chair at home than in my car.
Hold on to your seat and buckle up. There are at least half a dozen companies designing flying cars, including Terra Fugia. The Massachusetts-based firm envisions vehicles that will rise above roadways, vertically taking off and landing, unfolding wings and whisper quiet, whisking us into the future. For Here and Now, I'm Bruce Gilman.
It's been a rough Memorial Day weekend weather-wise in much of the country. Texas has seen the worst of it. At least 6 people have died there after heavy rains and severe flooding. Bandera, Texas, northwest of San Antonio, got nearly 10 inches of rain overnight. 9 people were in need of rescue, and there's been widespread damage. Near Houston, officials evacuated more than 2,500 inmates from 2 prisons along the rising Brazos River in advance of possible flooding. And other Texas communities issued mandatory evacuation orders, as one man told KPRC-TV, an NBC affiliate in Houston.
We knew it was coming, but at the same time, I mean, you don't prepare for something like this to pack up your whole house.
The National Weather Service says more flash floods are possible in South Central Texas today, and even more rain is in the forecast for later this week. While across the Plain States, severe thunderstorms, hail, and tornadoes are also possible today. And in the Carolinas, Tropical Depression Bonnie is dissipating, but is still bringing heavy rain and wind to North Carolina throughout the day. Bonnie already dropped about 8 inches of rain in South Carolina, closing a major highway and stirring up strong surf along the coast. Lifeguards in Georgia and the Carolinas are warning people about dangerous rip currents and urging people to stay out of the water because of rough conditions. A lot of wild weather. American jobs moving overseas to China. The issue has come up a lot in the campaign trail this year. According to the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute, more than 3 million American jobs have gone to China between 2001 and 2013. Well, now some of those manufacturing jobs are being taken from Chinese workers by robots. Foxconn, the provider for Apple and Samsung, has reportedly replaced tens of thousands of workers with robots in its Chinese factories. Foxconn denies that the robots will mean long-term job losses. So what will the impact be, and what could the impact be on the U.S.? Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us on Mondays from New York. Hi there, Derek.
Hi there.
So first of all, Derek, I've seen some pretty spectacular numbers. Some reports saying 60,000 Foxconn workers being replaced by robots. Tell us more.
That's right, 60,000. So Foxconn is the largest electronics manufacturer in the world that contracts for these major technology companies. It makes the iPhone, the iPad. It makes phones for Samsung and gaming consoles like the PlayStation. What's happening, I think, is that you have Chinese wages rising, and these manufacturing jobs that used to be exported to China, a lot of them are now going to even cheaper countries. And so Foxconn is under pressure to control costs from its clients. Apple, Samsung, Sony, these are all companies in extremely competitive industries that are constantly trying to find ways to increase profits. And China has recently embarked on a rather unprecedented buildup in these so-called industrial robots, that is, robots used to build stuff. And essentially, they are in many ways in the last few years on the leading edge of not just being a country that takes manufacturing work from other places around the world, but also replaces those very jobs with machines.
Well, given all the pressures that you just outlined on these Chinese manufacturers, how can Foxconn then deny that this automation or move to robots will mean long-term job losses? They're denying that.
They are denying that it's going to lead to long-term, I think is the key word here, job losses. At the same time, obviously, if you're going to replace 60,000 people with machines in the near term, you are going to have fewer workers. And that is precisely the point of automation in many ways. It is to make the manufacturing process more efficient, cheaper. You know, the U.S. is ahead of the Chinese economy in lots of ways, but China now is leading the world when it comes to this buildup in industrial machines. It is now the world's largest sales and growth market for industrial robots, according to the International Federation of Robotics, which keeps global data on this stuff. And in terms of, in terms of robot density, actually, it's kind of interesting that China is not among the world's leaders. It's 28th in the world, tied essentially with Portugal. So it has a long way to go. And I think in many ways, we could be seeing a lot more of this. Foxconn is an enormous story, partially because for various reasons relating to the iPhone and the debatable morality of the working conditions within the factories. It's a very famous name around the world in manufacturing.
Right. And I guess the other reason why it's an enormous story is that anything done in China, just by definition, is on a more enormous scale,
given the size
of the country. But, I mean, it also gives us a window into the future of work, period. And just moving back to the United States here, what numbers do we have about how many jobs have been lost in the U.S. to automation?
What we know is that manufacturing since the late 1970s has been essentially in secular decline as a source of work in the U.S. But one thing that's often missed in these reports is that that doesn't mean that manufacturing as production, as outcome, is in secular decline. In fact, we make more stuff in the U.S. than we've ever made before. We just need fewer people to do it. We've become more efficient, and technology is one of the things that's made us more efficient. We have many more jobs in the U.S. now, many more workers than we had in the late 1970s. So one thing that's happened is that manufacturing, which used to account for about a third of the workforce in the U.S., now accounts for closer to 10%, and a lot of these workers have gone on to work in so-called non-tradable sectors such as education and healthcare and even government and service sector jobs in retail and food and beverage. But one thing that some economists are looking at in the near future is what if some of those jobs get replaced by machines as well? Indeed, you have the former head of McDonald's saying that he sees that with higher minimum wage laws throughout the U.S., there is a greater benefit to replacing these workers with machines that serve our sodas and our burgers. There are some estimates, including one from recently from Oxford, that suggested that up to 50% of all occupations in the U.S. economy could be replaced by robots. That's a pretty stark figure.
Well, I'm hoping that it's at least a couple years before robots replace you and me, Derek. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks, as always, for talking with us, Derek.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.